We'll define all of those terms in just a moment. I want to begin with a look into the book of Daniel. When you mention Daniel, the first word in most minds is prophecy. The question to me is it primarily, and I say primarily, fulfilled prophecy, which makes it history to us, or is it yet to be? Well, this is a history course, so you can probably guess my perspective. I personally believe that if the church were as preoccupied with its history as it is with prophecy, she'd be all the better for it. That is not to denigrate prophecy, but instead to be amazed by its fulfillment. It's ironic that skeptics refuse to date Daniel early because of its uncanny, its supernatural accuracy in predicting ancient history. Yet many Christians would rather trust in the embarrassing failures of many modern prophecy teachers. Now, is that to say that all prophecy is fulfilled? That there are no mysteries left? That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that our illiteracy in history makes it impossible to even know the difference. How would we know whether it was fulfilled or not if we don't know anything about history? Okay? For anyone doing a simple reading in the book of Daniel, I would refer you to the notes in the New Geneva Study Bible, just as a simple scan. If you read those notes, there's an excellent way there to understand that the history that was fulfilled is a lot of what Daniel has foreseen. A lot of it has come to pass. Okay. Well, the book of Daniel has a series of visions, and in many of these visions, it represents the same events using different imagery with different details. And the fundamental idea is best represented by the vision in the second chapter. So, Daniel chapter 2, beginning with verse 31. "You looked, O king, and there before you stood a large statue, an enormous, dazzling statue, awesome in appearance. The head of the statue was made of pure gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. While you were watching, a rock was cut out, but not by human hands. It struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and smashed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were broken to pieces at the same time and became like chaff in the threshing floor in the summer. The wind swept them away without leaving a trace. But the rock that struck the statue," thank you, "the rock that struck the statue became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth." And then verse 36 begins Daniel's interpretation of this vision. "This was the dream, and now we will interpret it to the king. You, O king, are the king of kings. The God of heaven has given you dominion and power and might and glory. In your hands he has placed mankind and the beasts of the field and the birds of the air. Wherever they live, he has made you ruler over them all. You are that head of gold. After you, another kingdom will rise inferior to yours. Next, a third kingdom, one of bronze, will rule the whole earth. Finally, there will be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, for iron breaks and smashes everything. And as iron breaks things to pieces, so it will crush and break all the others." Down to verse 44. "In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it will itself endure forever. This is the meaning of the vision of the rock cut out of a mountain, but not by human hands, a rock that broke the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold to pieces. The great God has shown the king what will take place in the future. The dream is true, and the interpretation is trustworthy." So here, Nebuchadnezzar, king of the Chaldeans, has seen a vision of a statue. And I apologize for that graphic. It's not the greatest. That's all I could come up with, though. It is a statue that begins with a head of gold. It then passes through a chest and arms made of silver, into then the stomach, the belly, the thighs of brass, and finally ends with legs and feet made of iron and clay. And Daniel reveals that these materials represent a succession of kings or of empires that will rise and fall before God establishes his never-ending kingdom. Now, the coming of Christ inaugurates that kingdom. He is that stone cut without human hands. We simply await its consummation. Now, Daniel's prophecy is now history. We are privy to what Nebuchadnezzar was not told, and that is the identity of these kingdoms. Daniel himself tells us that the head of gold was Nebuchadnezzar's own kingdom, that of Babylon, also represented in Daniel 7 by a lion with eagle's wings. And if you've ever seen some of the motifs of ancient Persia and of Babylon, they have a lion with wings on it. That's one of their motifs. We've already seen that kingdom fall to the silver kingdom, that is the Medes and the Persians under Cyrus the Great. And then in last week's lesson, Alexander conquered the Persians in their turn, and this was something that's predicted in greater detail in Daniel chapter 8. In fact, the Jewish historian Josephus claimed that Alexander spared Jerusalem when the high priest showed him the 8th chapter. In that chapter, the ram of Persia was defeated by a one-horned goat from the west, a symbol that the Greek armies had been using. Archaeologists have discovered that symbol with the Greek army. So Daniel chapter 8, verse 20. Sorry. The ram which you saw having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia, and the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king. Now, if the story that Josephus tells is true, which it may not be, but Alexander, if it were true, should have looked closer at chapter 8, because the large horn, it says, is broken into four pieces. And verse 22 tells us that four kingdoms shall rise out of that nation, meaning Greece, but not with its power. Well, that's the subject of our lesson this week and next. The remnants of what Alexander left behind and their impact upon Judea. Here, God's preparations are intensified. The Jews are going to be swept from one corner of the Mediterranean basin to the other, all in preparation of the announcement of God's everlasting dominion under the Messiah. And that will take place under the Roman Empire, which is the legs of iron in Daniel's chapter 2 vision. Okay? That's a lot of material, and we haven't even done the review. So here it is. Here's the review. In last week's lesson, we saw the Jews, they returned from exile to the land of Yehud, which is Judea. Under the Persians, Jerusalem was established as a temple state, governed by the high priest under the authority of the Lex Mosaica, that is the law of Moses. That was the law of the land, was the law of Moses. Now, for over a century, the Jews languished in the rubble of the old city. And Ezra and Nehemiah worked to reestablish a less tenuous hold there in Judea. Ezra by rebuilding their liturgy in the temple worship, and Nehemiah by rebuilding the walls. We also saw how Nehemiah jealously observed God's command against foreign marriages, and he drove the pagan worshiping wives from the city. He was determined to keep them from making the same mistakes which had caused the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 BC. And finally, we saw the rise of Alexander the Great. And Alexander was a man tutored in philosophy, yet he retained the brutality and the ambitions of his father. And we noted four important effects of this Alexandrian conquest. The single most important result of his success was the unification of the world under Hellenism, the culture of the Greeks. The mechanism for that unification, what brought them together, was syncretism. And we define syncretism as the merging of various religious beliefs into one. Okay? Now, out of that unification came the pervasive use of Koine Greek and some elements of a common culture. And that's going to prepare the world for the evangelists of the first century and for the writing of the New Testament. We also saw the founding of Alexandria, Egypt, which is going to be a future center of Hellenistic Judaism. And we're going to take a little closer look at the importance of Alexandria today. Finally, we saw that the seeds of emperor worship were brought from the east to the west on the back, basically, of Alexander's legend. And that form of syncretism will eventually lead to the persecution of the church under the Romans. Okay? That's the review. Any questions before we begin this week? Okay. In this lesson, we're going to examine the dramatic collision between Judaism and Hellenism after Alexander's death. As Alexander lay dying, his generals came to him and asked him this question: "To which of your generals do you leave your kingdom?" And Alexander replied, "To the strongest." I think Alexander knew that his infant son would never live to inherit his kingdom. That's simply not the way of the world, and he understood that. For a time, these generals, who were known as the Diadochi, made the pretense of preserving the empire in this child's name. But in short order, Alexander's half-brother was murdered. His mother was put to death, although don't feel sorry for her because she's the one that murdered the half-brother. Finally, his wife and son were assassinated. So now with all the claims to the throne gone, Greece fell into civil war, which is typically what happens. When the dust finally cleared, there were four generals who had carved up the empire, which of course brings us back to those four broken horns in Daniel chapter 8. Now there were two kingdoms centered around Greece, that was Macedonia and Thrace, and we're not going to deal with them. They don't enter into this picture. But there were two kingdoms that were carved out of the old Persian Empire and from Egypt. Daniel chapter 11 calls these generals of Alexander the king of the north and the king of the south. Now, chapter 11 is one of the most fascinating chapters in Scripture if you keep one eye on history. Every verse in there is filled historically in such detail that chapter 11 alone would prove the divine authorship of Scripture, which is why critics refuse to believe Daniel wrote the book when he says he wrote the book. They say that he must have wrote it as a contemporary of these events instead of looking forward. Okay? So, again, just grab a New Geneva Study Bible, kind of scan through those notes, and you'll see the level of detail that is in that chapter. Now, the first of these kings we're going to look at is the king of the north. His name was Seleucus I, or Seleucus Nicator, which means victor. All of the generals were very capable men, and Seleucus was no exception. He established the Seleucid Empire, which covered most of the old Persian territory in what is now modern-day Syria, Iraq, and Iran. Now, originally, he and another general named Ptolemy, who we'll talk about in a minute, they agreed to combine their forces to defeat the strongest of their opponents, the strongest general that Alexander had had. And they met together, and on paper, they carved up their empires. And at that meeting, it was decided that Ptolemy would get Judea. But when the pivotal battle took place, Ptolemy's army was late to the battlefield, and Seleucus and his army bore the brunt of the fight. Because of that, Seleucus refused to honor their agreement, and he kept Judea for himself. Now, I want you to look at a map, a small map, okay, but you can see the two empires there. And look at the land of Palestine in this area right here. The only land bridge between Europe and Africa, caught between these two superpowers and actually the object of their discord. And yet this is entirely within the supervision of God's design, because within a few generations, the wars between these two Greek nations will have swept Jews in every direction, back and forth, all through the Mediterranean basin. Okay? Now, before we take a look at Ptolemy, I do want to mention that Seleucus had two important cities that he founded, one important for the present, the other one important for the past. The first city was named after himself and is now modern-day Baghdad. So he is responsible for Baghdad. That, of course, is important for the present. The other city that he founded was Antioch in Syria, and it was named after his father Antiochus. And centuries later, Antioch is going to become the center of Gentile Christianity. You could say that after the fall of Jerusalem, it becomes the first capital of Christianity there in Antioch. So that's going to be important in the history of the church. Okay? So that's the king of the north. Now, as we said, the king of the south was named Ptolemy. His full title is Ptolemy the First Soter. That word means savior. He got that name in battle. Basically, he saved the city, and he kept That is his title. He was the son of a Macedonian noble, and Ptolemy proved to be a very capable ruler, eventually turning Egypt into the wealthiest nation on the Mediterranean. Now, although both Ptolemy and Seleucus had inherited Alexander's vision of Hellenism, it was manifested quite differently. The Hellenism of Seleucus was closer to Alexander's, and the Seleucids actually tried to assimilate cultures, even by force. They were active in trying to conform their subjects to Hellenism. The Ptolemies were more conservative. They didn't embrace the native population quite as easily as the Seleucids did. And so, in Ptolemy's reign, the major cities were the ones that became Hellenized, but the interior remained what we would say is Egyptian. But then when the migration of new Greeks into Egypt trailed off, the culture they were supposed to assimilate basically began to assimilate them. So Egyptian heritage reemerged, and the Ptolemies themselves began to dress and to behave like the ancient pharaohs. That is why the very last Ptolemy, the end of the line, centuries later, is portrayed as an Egyptian instead of the Greek that she really was. And that was Cleopatra. Okay, she was actually Greek, even though you see Elizabeth Taylor in the movie dressed up as an Egyptian. Okay. Now in 312 BC, Ptolemy invaded Palestine. He did that to enforce the original agreement that Seleucus had broken concerning Judea. Now, Josephus complains very, very bitterly that Ptolemy took the city by coming on the Sabbath. And the Jews refused to fight on the Sabbath. So they just took the city. So Judea became Ptolemaic territory. And the most important aspect of that conquest, of all of these conquests, is that there's going to be deportations of Jews back into Egypt. In that day, whenever a city or a nation was defeated in battle, it was typical that large numbers of captives were returned to the conquering empire, whether as trophies or as slaves. In this case, it was no different. They brought them back mostly as slaves, and they were in bondage again. So thousands of Jews were taken from Jerusalem. They were relocated in Egypt, mostly around Alexandria. And so this is where the Western diaspora, remember we talked about the diaspora, that's the dispersion of the Jews throughout this area being taken from their homeland. So this Western diaspora here really began to expand. Where God had brought Israel out of Egypt, Ptolemy brought many of their great-great-great-grandchildren back, but again, only by divine supervision. Well, after remaining slaves under Ptolemy I, the Jews were freed under his son Ptolemy II. Called Philadelphus. Now, most of those who were freed chose to stay instead of returning to Palestine. Now, as this diasporan community grew in affluence and in status, Ptolemy II sent an invitation to the wealthiest families of Jerusalem to immigrate to Alexandria, and hundreds of the wealthiest people in Jerusalem decided to accept his offer. And so the result of these events is that by the time of Christ, there were at least 1 million Jews back in Egypt. So it was a natural choice for Joseph and Mary to flee to Egypt when the Christ child was being pursued by Herod. Okay? So Alexandria had become the center of Western Judaism. A Greek-speaking population grew up among the transplanted Jews. That provided the impetus for the most critical event since the return of the Jews from captivity. In the 3rd century BC, the first Greek translation of the Old Testament was produced. We call it the Septuagint. Whoops, missed one. There we go, Septuagint. That's from its Latin name, Interpretario Septuaginta, which means the interpretation of the 70. And there are many legends concerning its production and where it got its name. We'll just look at a couple of those. The most famous legend is probably the least likely. According to this tradition, the translation was created at the request of Ptolemy II for his new museum and library. Now, Ptolemy was a great patron of the arts, and he was a patron of learning, and the library he founded there was the greatest in the ancient world, so at least it's plausible. It's the method of the translation that is somewhat questionable. According to the legend, it was Ptolemy's librarian who brought the Old Testament writings to the king's attention. The king then sent to Jerusalem for scholars to come to Alexandria and to translate them. And each tribe, each of the 12 tribes, was represented by 6 scholars. And to demonstrate the supernatural origins of the scriptures, each scholar produced his own translation, and then miraculously each translation was exactly the same, according to the tradition. Now, did you catch that the number of scholars actually equals 72, not 70? So there's a problem with that tradition anyway. Another tradition is a little more likely. The ancient Jews, like many cultures, had a system of encoding the alphabet into numerals. That system for the Jews was called gematria. Every Hebrew letter was assigned a numerical value so that a word could be encrypted with a number. Does 666 ring a bell? Okay. The Hebrew slang for the Gentiles as a whole was the phrase Gog and Magog. When you encrypt that, it becomes 70. So being the first translation of the Hebrew scriptures into a Gentile language, the reference to 70 might have been more of a derision, more of an insult. This is the translation for Gog and Magog, 70. Okay? Just a couple of traditions there. Now, in reality, we'll probably never know how it came to be, but its importance is beyond question. By the time of Christ, the Septuagint, for all practical purposes, was the authorized version of the Scriptures. Few Jews had retained their Hebrew tongue, and even Aramaic speakers quoted the Septuagint instead of the Hebrew text. In fact, a number of Christ quotations of the Old Testament are from the Septuagint and not from the original Hebrew. The Scripture of the common man, including Christ and the apostles, was the Septuagint. So there's a stamp of approval anyway, in a sense. But the importance of the Septuagint transcends the Jews. It became a bridge for the early Gentile converts to Christianity into the history and the revelation of their new faith. That's why Everett Ferguson gives us this quote. He says, "The Septuagint is the most important single development of any kind in the Hellenistic period for the background of early Christianity." The Jews of the first and second centuries recognized this as well, because after the first century, the Christians kept using the Septuagint to show that the Old Testament pointed to Christ. And the Jews had a difficulty answering that. And so they referred to the Septuagint as the worst thing to happen to Israel since the golden calf. Okay? So the Septuagint really is the greatest missionary translation ever produced. By the way, another important aspect of Septuagint is because the Jews, when their Torahs became weathered, basically would bury them. They were lost. So the Septuagint is actually our oldest existing copies of the Old Testament, not the Hebrew text, but the Greek text in Septuagint. Okay? Any questions or comments? And don't be shy. Okay, you're all shy. Okay. Another development that seems to have kind of coalesced and solidified during this period is something nearly as critical. That was the synagogue. You recall that when the Jews returned from captivity, there was this new emphasis on biblical instruction. That led to the scribe, but it also needed an outlet for this instruction. Now, the original outlet of this instruction is unclear. Like I said before, in earlier classes, we really don't know the exact origins of the Septuagint. But by the 3rd century BC, we see definite traces of the early synagogues or places of assembly there in Egypt. Eventually, the law was developed that whenever you had at least 10 Jewish males, a synagogue could be formed. So that by the time of Christ, synagogues were scattered throughout the Mediterranean basin. And these synagogues were critical to the early church for a number of reasons. The synagogue provided the model for early church assemblies. It was the model for the local church that even continues today. The synagogue provided a model as a place of prayer, a place of worship, and a place of instruction. New revelation wasn't given to the church about the pattern of its meetings. Paul's letters about order and church government were really a reaffirmation of the way God's people had been governed and instructed for centuries under the synagogues. Okay? And then, as we've said before, this is very important for the growth of the church because the synagogues represented ready-made centers of evangelism. Throughout these lessons, we're going to see how this continuing conflict over Judea scattered these Jews to the far corners of the known world, and their synagogues were built wherever they went. That makes them ready-made places where evangelists can go, preach the gospel, and make converts. And God prepares all that before the first century. Another aspect of the synagogue is somewhat interesting. At least when we look at the scripture and we see in the gospels the stories of Christ and we see the stories of the apostles, this is kind of an interesting footnote in that, is that remember that under the Persians and the Greeks, most Jews had lost their Hebrew language. Well, in the synagogues, after the Hebrew text had been read, and of course, many of the people there would not understand it, an officer of the assembly would arise and give a paraphrase known as a targum. And that paraphrase was in Aramaic, which was the language of the Hebrews at the time. So when we look at the Gospels, we see that when Christ rose to read Isaiah in Luke chapter 4, or when Paul was called to give an exhortation after reading the law in Acts 13, what they were doing was following a long-established pattern that continues to this day. Whenever our pastors rise and address us and exhort us in instruction, they are doing exactly what the synagogues had done centuries earlier. And so that tradition is still here. That is the method of instruction. Okay? We cannot escape the fact that whatever the intentions were of the Jews, the synagogues arose out of God's decree that He would save people using what Paul calls the foolishness of preaching. And so He gave ready-made places for that preaching to occur in the first century. That's where it's going to take place. So the synagogues arose in anticipation of Christ and for Christ. And we actually see that that's exactly what happened. If we notice Christ's words at His trial in John 18:20, I hope I have that there. Yes. He says, "I have spoken openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues or at the temple, where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said." The Gospels don't preserve, apparently, a lot of the teaching that Jesus did in the synagogues. But here in His own words, He said that's where He went. Synagogue or the temple. Same way with the apostles. Until they were no longer allowed there. Which will be much later. Okay? Questions about the synagogue? Or the Septuagint? Okay. All right. Well, before Christ would say these words that we just read in John 18 in the first century, Judaism and Hellenism are going to begin a struggle for supremacy there in Palestine. When God uprooted the idolatry of the Jews in the captivity, which we looked at in previous lessons, remember, He crushed this longing within them for foreign gods that we see throughout the Old Testament. In name, at least, they were now the people of Yahweh. But the appeal of Hellenism was not for other gods. It was really more for secularism, something we're very familiar with today. It was the idolatry of the self and of pleasure. So once again, the Jews faced a foe within themselves that threatened to destroy them as the people of God, just as secularism threatens to destroy us. Well, there were four wars that were fought over Palestine between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. And in 198 BC, the Seleucids succeeded in taking Judea out of Egyptian hands. And remember that Hellenism was far more aggressive under the Seleucids than the Ptolemies. The Ptolemies basically left them alone. But now the Seleucids are going to try to force Hellenism upon them. And they combine that with the petty ambitions of the high priest, and so this brings about a very disgraceful chapter in the history of Israel. Get the background here. During this period, a feud began between two prominent Jerusalem families. You had the house of Ananias. They were the descendants of the line of Zadok being the high priest under Solomon. every high priest was, up to this time, was a descendant of Zadok. Their family had held that office continuously, okay? And that didn't change once the return to Jerusalem and the rebuilding of the temple. The other house, the house of Tobias, was descended from the governor of Ammon, who was one of Nehemiah's enemies. So they were of mixed heritage. How they became so prominent, you know, when the Jews are again supposed to be guarding their purity, is already questionable, okay? Well, what the house of Tobias succeeded in doing, they couldn't take the high priest at this point, but they did take away the taxation authority of the Onaiads. And so that left them without a flow of money. And so without money, the office of high priest is basically politically irrelevant. You know, there's no power there with no money flow. And so this struggle goes on between these two houses. There's a feud going on. And so after several murders, there's various plots and schemes, both the houses decide that they're going to appeal to the Seleucid king to mediate this problem. And that king at the time was Antiochus IV. Well, unknown to Onias, who was the high priest at this time, his brother Jason had already betrayed him and had gotten to Antiochus first. He had bribed Antiochus and had secretly purchased the office of high priest already, so that when Onias arrived, he was murdered. His son was forced to flee for his life, and he fled to Egypt. When he got there, he built his own temple. So once again, there were three temples, Jerusalem, Egypt, and Samaria. Well, as if that weren't scandalous enough, Jason, who is now the high priest, began a concentrated effort to transform Jerusalem into a Greek city-state. Under the direction of Antiochus, he began a program of forced Hellenization. So he created this city council and he patterned it after the Greek city-states. He built a gymnasium. He built theaters for performing Greek plays. Some sources even claim that there were efforts to rename Jerusalem Antioch. So in essence, the high priest is now a Seleucid official. Okay? Many of the Jews of Jerusalem, especially the young, upwardly mobile types, embraced this new lifestyle. They wore Greek fashions. In particular, they mention a certain broad-brimmed hat that the Orthodox Jews found offensive. They didn't like that. They adopted Greek mannerisms. The book of the Maccabees tells us that the young priests would rush through their duties at the temple so that they could get to the gymnasium and exercise. And they exercised in the Greek fashion. That is, they exercised in the nude. The worst insult of all is that some of these young Jews were tired of being teased by their Greek friends. They underwent a surgical procedure to hide their circumcisions. So at this point, they've apostatized. Okay? They've turned their back on the historic faith. Yet even with all of Jason's efforts here, some Hellenized Jews were still not satisfied with his leadership. They wanted more of this. So the extreme Hellenized party, including this house of Tobias, went back to Antiochus. They offered an even bigger bribe. And so they deposed Jason. So for the very first time, the priesthood was taken out of the priestly line of Zadok. No longer in the line of Zadok. It was that apostasy, more than any other, that led many of the Jews that were on the fence, uncommitted one way or the other, to join the opposition to the Seleucids. And that's what we're going to look at next week. Okay? I need some questions. Yeah.
I'm curious. You said that in the part about the Septuagint that we relied primarily on the Greek text. Excuse me. Is there little or no reference to the original Hebrew and Aramaic that we can compare to? I mean, how does that work within the Dead Sea Scrolls and all of that?
Yeah, we have discovered portions of the Hebrew text that are ancient, but none of them that I'm aware of predate the Septuagint. Remember, the Dead Sea Scrolls are still, you know, around the time of Christ, that era. So the Septuagint being a couple of centuries before that, that remains, as far as I'm aware, the oldest text that we have. And it's the comparisons by looking at the Greek text and looking at what Hebrew text we do have that we can see that Christ or the apostles were quoting from the Septuagint and not from the Hebrew text. Little changes, just like you look in translations, you know, between even English versions. You could tell if it was recorded, you know, had those words recorded, you could tell which version you were reading from. It's kind of the same thing. So we know what they were looking at, what they were using. Okay, because they had lost their language. You know, we talked about how their traditions were a hedge around them, but and they were able to guard against Hellenism to a degree. But even then, after decade of that, it begins to filter in. And so all the nations around them being Hellenized and speaking Greek, and of course coming from the captivity where they also had lost their original Hebrew and were speaking Aramaic. So there were very few people that actually spoke Hebrew and read Hebrew. And that's what we're talking about in the synagogue, where they would read it in Hebrew as deference to the way it was supposed to be done. They would do that kind of as a tradition, but then somebody had to get up and give a paraphrase in Aramaic. Okay, and in a sense, that kind of begins this whole process of reading the text and then expounding on the text that we continue even today. We'll do this morning. Okay.
So there's more so confirmation than that the spirit of the text is what we rely so heavily on, more so than the written aspect, I guess.
There is, when we look at the Septuagint, we look at the Hebrew text, and we look at our various translations of the New, or sources of the New Testament, there are some minor deviations here and there, but nothing that would change, as you said, the spirit of the revelation. Okay. Anything else? Other questions? This is actually a very important period in the sense because if you remember that map, that's the main thing right there, is that Christianity and the gospel is going to sweep the Mediterranean basin. It's going to just spread at a phenomenal rate. That's not going to happen unless there is some kind of unifying culture, language, which Alexander provides, plus people who are familiar with the Old Testament and who are looking for a Messiah. Okay, and so the majority of the early converts to Christianity are actually Jews of the diaspora who were spread out. And so you see in this time period that God, as they fight over Judea back and forth, he's just taking those people and doing this with them. He just spreads them all around that eastern end of the Mediterranean basin, back and forth. Okay, so that when the gospel is ready to go forth, they just begin going in those directions. And the first place they would go when they arrived at a city was at a synagogue. And they would say, look, you've been looking for the Messiah. Well, he's come. And they'd preach the gospel to them. And they'd have their converts there. And kind of a side issue or little tidbit of history, I guess, is if you notice when Paul goes to Philippi, he doesn't go to a synagogue. He actually meets Lydia at a stream. And just like I said, this is for free, historical tidbit for free, is that Philippi was actually a military city. It had been given to ex-soldiers when Augustus Caesar had won a victory there. And so he gave this city of Philippi to them so that it's kind of like a retirement community. And a synagogue was not allowed on this actual soil there because of its foreign influence. And they wanted to guard their military citizens from that influence as well. They wanted to keep them loyal to Rome, so that it was against the law for them to establish the synagogue there. And so that's why Paul, when he goes to Philippi, it's one of the few places he goes, and he does not end up going to a synagogue. He ends up meeting Lydia at a stream. You know. Anything else? Okay, Jordan, would you close, please?
Gracious Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time and opportunity for us to study your history, Lord, and we